It's been a while since we've heard one of my favorite songs from Joe Bonamassa, Blue and Evil. Have a listen. Dr. Kenneth Pargaman is a professor of clinical psychology at Bowling Green State University. Dr. Pargaman has been a leading figure in the effort to bring a more balanced view of religious life to the attention of social scientists and health professionals. He has published over 250 articles in religion and mental health. He is the author of Psychology of Religion and Coping, Spiritually Integrated Psychotherapy, Understanding and Addressing the Sacred. Oh, this just sounds fascinating. All of this stuff. He is editor-in-chief of the recently published two-time APA Handbook of Psychology, Religion, and Spirituality. Dr. Pargaman has consulted with several foundations, the National Institutes of Health, United States Army, World Health Organization, and the John Templeton Foundation. His bio continues, but if that hasn't impressed you enough, nothing will. He's on the line with us right now, Dr. Kenneth Pargaman. Sir, how are you today?
Good. How are you?
Do you get tired when people read that whole bio? I mean, that's just ridiculous.
Well, I'd like to meet that guy. He sounds pretty interesting.
Sounds amazing. Amazing. Okay, so the correlation between spirituality and mental health, I mean, does it come down to something that you could say, is it as simple as this? There is a correlation, and those who are spiritual or those who are attaining or trying to attain some sort of spiritual growth in their lives, this is a key component in them getting better. Is that a true statement?
I don't think it's completely accurate. You know, psychology always hedges its bets, but I think the more accurate way of putting it is whether spirituality relates to mental health depends on the kind of spirituality we're talking about.
Right.
And you can distinguish healthy forms of spirituality from forms of spirituality that can be downright destructive.
Right, right. Okay, so just in your study, in your research, in the last 10 years, what has been the one thing that you would say has been the most profound discovery?
Well, I had assumed that generally people who look to their faith in the most difficult times, that it would be generally a real positive force in their lives, and I think that's true. And I also thought that for some people, when they encounter major trauma or trouble, their faith can be shaken, but that ultimately leads them to growth and transformation. But what we've been finding is that when people are shaken to the core, it doesn't necessarily lead to growth or transformation. Sometimes people are just damaged and in some cases destroyed. These what we call spiritual struggles are very profound. They touch people at the deepest levels, and sometimes people don't recover.
As a hospital chaplain, I've heard stories of doctors coming in while the chaplain is there, asking the chaplain to leave, and then even maybe saying to the head of chaplaincy or to the department or to that chaplain, we don't really, you know, maybe they weren't as direct as this, but we don't really need you here. Do you think the role of a hospital chaplain can be helped out or validated by your work?
I think so. Matter of fact, chaplains have been some of the biggest fans of this kind of work because it basically provides the raison d'etre, the reason why they're so vital in hospital settings. That patients come to hospitals with psychological, social, physical issues. But they're also often dealing with, you know, a lot of spiritual distress. And for many patients, that spiritual distress can be more troubling than the psychological, social, or physical issues. And who talks about those issues?
Right.
Who do they deal with that? You know, physicians aren't trained to do that. Nurses generally don't receive training in the area.
Right.
And so for most people, they just keep it to themselves, which
okay.
is, we're learning really, you know, that's got some negative implications for health and well-being.
Well, hold on. Let me ask you this. What's your spiritual background? And are you okay talking about it? Because I think if people want to actually read your research, read the information that you write about. They would like to know how you are informed by this. And if you're this interested in the correlation between mental health and spirituality, religion, etc., you must have some kind of a spiritual journey yourself.
Well, that's the question most people are interested in. Anyone who's doing this work, they want to know whether the person they're listening to is
biased,
you know, some kind of axe to grind, you know, a devout evangelical or a devout atheist. But my background's Jewish, and I was personally interested in learning more about what that meant. I didn't grow up in an Orthodox environment, more of a conservative, culturally based Jewish environment, but I didn't know why it was so important to me. But I made a decision early on. I wanted to learn about the religions of the world rather than just Judaism. So I started going to churches and mosques and temples, and was welcomed by everyone. And, you know, it's really been informative for me, not just as a scientist, but more personally. All this has enriched my own Judaism.
Okay, so let's kind of get this down to practical terms. Someone's laying in the hospital. They're sick with whatever. And someone might try to help them help strengthen them spiritually, you know. And really, I read a study a couple of years ago that suggested the greater your imagination is, the greater your prayer life will be. If you are someone who's not really imaginative, then your prayer life sucks. And so what we're talking about here is, you know, there's a fine line between the power of positive thinking movement and faith, spirituality. The difference is that, well, there's many differences, but one of the things I can imagine in this conversation is those who are spiritual or religious are putting their faith in a higher power of some sort, whereas the power of positive thinking movement is really just putting that higher power in themselves and sort of almost self-healing. Do you understand where I'm going with this line of conversation, or are you as confused as I am?
Well, I actually think there's a third approach, and I think the you know, the focusing on God versus the focusing on the positive within oneself, those are two pathways. But another pathway is to see something sacred within yourself, or to see something sacred in your relationships or in the legacy you may have left in your life. And so I think there's a whole nother conversational door that we can open if we're just more, I think, sensitive to the various ways people experience the sacred in their lives, not just in terms of God, but in terms of virtually anything, nature, work, loving relationships. All these can be sources of sacredness, and those are the kinds of things that I think are most helpful actually to talk about with many patients in the hospital. You know, where do you find sacredness? Where do you find peace? How can you, you know, let's talk about what you've done with your life and the legacy you've left behind. Those are kind of psycho-spiritual types of questions that, again, open the door to a really important conversation.
What's discouraging in what you study? What's the dark side of what you do?
Well, you know, the toughest part is just trying to deal with the skepticism of my colleagues, the skepticism of people in medicine and mental health. It's kind of tough because we as a group are abnormal. And by that, I mean that in the statistical sense, that people in mental health and in medicine generally are not like the people that we serve. We are far less religious and spiritual on average than the people who we treat and work with. And so I think we as a group tend to underestimate the power of spirituality. And so when I, you know, even when you show up, people who should be open to the data, that the data are saying this is really important. We need to deepen our approach to healthcare. We need to truly make it holistic. And the data are clear. You get people who are so skeptical about it, I think in part because it's a kind of path that they turned away from themselves and are so deeply skeptical and sometimes antagonistic.
Give me an example, please. Would you mind? I mean, what was, for example, one of the most antagonistic experiences that you've ever had with someone in the medical profession in regards to you know, again, this work that you do?
Well, I remember I was actually giving talks to some national journalists from all over the world, and it was all about trying to educate them about religion and spirituality so they could write more cogent, more cogently about it. And, you know, I went through a kind of 2-3 hour lecture in the morning to these eminent journalists and talking about how We need to get past simple statements and get past stereotypes about religion and spirituality and take a look at it as a rich dimension that's every bit as rich as our mental health and our physical health. And after I did what I thought was a really great job, one of the journalists stood up and said, well, I just want you to know, I think that religion and spirituality are the single most destructive force in the world today. And
wow,
you know, I could have just been talking to myself in a closet for all the impact I had.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Well,
yeah,
I guess,
you know, everybody, there's nobody neutral about this topic. Everyone has something of emotional power around it, and so
okay. So, do you have the proof? Do you have the proof? Because that's really what's going to speak to these guys or these people. Sorry, that was sexist. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I understand. Well, we do have developing a really quite a bit of research support, and I think you spoke to my colleague Harold Koenig just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he's done massive review of the literature. You know, literally hundreds of studies now showing links between different aspects of religion and spirituality and health and well-being, and including, you know, increasing your life expectancy. And on the other hand, my research group, we've done studies that show that people who are really shaken to the core in their lives, that can lead to declines in the immune system, that can actually increase the risk of dying. So we're talking about, you know, the deeper dimension of life that has profound implications for health and well-being. And the fact that we really haven't taken it seriously enough, I think, is something that's starting to change, but we have a lot more to go.
What about miracles? You know, that's an entirely different subject, and yet obviously it's directly connected. have you ever seen a bona fide medical miracle?
Well, not myself. I mean, I've certainly seen things that are, you know, events that I'm so grateful for and so appreciative of. But, you know, from a scientific point of view, you know, miracles are outside of our realm. We can't prove them. We can't disprove them. Like we can't prove or disprove God. That's not what we can do. But we can certainly look at what's been called the footprints left by faith. And we can look at beliefs in miracles, and we can look at the hope in miracles. And all of those things seem to be really important. To have some hope in an extraordinary transformation or a miracle, that's really important for people's lives. And to believe in that, that's really important. Do they actually occur? I don't know. I don't have a miracle machine. I don't have a Godmatron that can measure those things. But believing in them certainly makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think, you know, in this whole conversation, there's a lot of pride on both sides. There's the holy rollers that think science and doctors are morons. And then there are doctors and scientists who think that religious people are morons. And I think there's pride on both sides. Would you agree?
Well, you know, I think to disparage either group just doesn't make any sense to me.
But is that not what's happening?
It is.
Yeah.
And it's a sad thing because, in fact, there's a lot to be learned and gained by forming cooperation between religious and medical and mental health communities. Because it all comes together, and if it doesn't come together, that's a sign of trouble, too. You know, for religious groups that refuse to have anything to do with organized medical care, that's absurd, because you then end up increasing the risk of lots of kinds of trouble. And on the other hand, for medical and mental health communities to avoid having any contact with religious communities is absurd, because sometimes the people we see and the problems that we're dealing with are directly related to religious life. And how can you ignore it?
You know, the only anecdotal correlation I can make in this conversation is this. I'm thinking about the amount of times I have visited a patient, have been called in as a chaplain. Someone's ready to pass. You know, they're doing the death breath. And the amount of times that I go in and pray for the family, for that patient, just create a bit of a sacred moment, and then that patient dies as soon as I finish or shortly thereafter, is very, very high. I haven't done the numbers, but I would say 70% of the time that's what happens. So for me,
how do you make sense of that?
I just see that as it's almost a whatever gets you through the night thing. Again, I don't give a holy grunt what they believe, but I used to kind of poo-poo the whole whatever gets you through the night because I would like to base my faith on truth. You know, that's what evangelical Christians used to, right? They got the corner on truth. But these days, until you see someone suffering pre-death, gasping and gurgling, and just this horrific, painful scenario with the family watching, until you see that, not until you see that will you have the compassion that comes with whatever gets you through the night.
Well, and I would say, too, that the sacred moment, as you described it, that you provide them may also give them the peace of mind, peace of spirit to let go and finally be able to move on. You know, it's funny you use those terms because we've been doing work on what we call sacred moments. And these are sacred moments that occur in loving, caring relationships, including relationships between mental health professionals and clients and caregivers and their aging parents. And these are the moments of profound kind of connection between people where you feel like time has stopped and you feel like you're in touch with a deep truth. And those kinds of moments are not unusual at all. And what we found is that people, those sacred moments in the context of loving relationships, including chaplaincy, that's what makes a difference. To me, that's like the healing ingredient. I kind of think of them as the un-PTSD moments.
Yeah.
These sacred moments, they become seared into your memory, and you remember them the rest of your life, and they make life worth living. And not only for the patients and the families, but we've also found that
caregivers
who are helpers and caregivers, when they have sacred moments, it also helps them in finding their work meaningful and sustaining them in the kind of work that you're talking about, Drew, which, you know, chaplaincy is a tough, tough, tough job. And how do you sustain yourself day in, day out when you're dealing with people, you know, on the edge of, on that threshold that you're describing? Well, sacred moments seem to be one of these ingredients of growth and healing and transformation. So we're really fascinated in learning more about just what you described.
Well, I've said this ad nauseum on this show, so for my listeners who've heard me say this too often or for anyone else in the room, C.S. Lewis would often quote the Celts, talk about the Celts and how they talked about these places around the world called thin places, where the gap between the creator and the created, for whatever reason, felt thin. Some would say Stonehenge was a thin place. But the thinnest place that I've ever been to, and I've been to many of the geographical places around the world, whether it's Jerusalem or Stonehenge or whatever, the thinnest place are the moments in a hospital room or in a palliative care unit where someone is about to pass, where they're on they're on the edge of glory.
Right. Yeah. Another eminent pastor, Edwin Friedman, in a book called Generation to Generation, talked about those periods as hinges of time, which I really like. Hinges
nice.
Of time.
Yeah.
Where you're on the threshold of something and the door is opening. And you're in the kind of a sacred space and a sacred time.
You are a fascinating individual. What a pleasure to have you on the show. Dr. Kenneth Pargament, he is, I know he probably doesn't like this moniker, but he is an expert on mental health and religion and, of course, the correlation between those two journeys, really. So I appreciate your time, sir. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and it was good talking to you.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye.
I would like to spend this brief moment here to introduce everyone to our lovely intern, Megs, who is going to step up to the microphone and have her radio debut.
Megs.
Reading her first commercial live on air. How about a rousing round of applause for Megs the intern?
Megs.
Yes. All right. Now listen to this phlegmy voice.
Hello. All right, I'm just going to go.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm the worst at this. Why do they get me to do anything? Okay. Maybe you've been thinking about advertising your organization on the radio, but don't really have the budget for a long-term marketing campaign.
Uh-huh.
Well, what if we gave you an entire show?
No.
The Drew Marshall Show is currently offering an innovative and affordable advertising concept for the small business owner. With web stats and listenership at an all-time high, Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show is offering you an opportunity to partner with us for an entire show. Become a one-day advertising partner and we'll introduce you to our listening audience for the day. Drew will mention your organization every hour during our four-hour show.
That's four times.
And we'll give you a live five-minute phone interview.
Say it isn't so.
Oh, and one more thing.
Yes?
We'll also post your logo and website link on our website for an entire month.
That's crazy.
Crazy. So if you're thinking about promoting a special event, product, or upcoming sale, or if you just want to test the radio advertising waters without a huge investment, then consider becoming a one-day advertising partner with The Drew Marshall Show. Contact us through our website, drewmarshall.ca, and ask about becoming a one-day advertising partner.
Ladies and gentlemen, Meg's the intern.
Yeah,
yes!
Meg!
Knocked it out of the park. Right out of the park. So proud of her.